Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bing, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Nanyang Assistant Professor of History, Florence Mok, to talk about her book, which is published in 2023, Covert Colonialism: Governance, Surveillance and Political Culture in British Hong Kong from 1966 to 1997. This book fills the gap by researching and explored history of colonial governance and political culture in Hong Kong during a critical period for both Chinese society and colonial government in Hong Kong. His author, Florence Mok, who is talking to us today, is a historian of colonial Hong Kong and modern China at the Nanyang Technological University and has published widely on Hong Kong and state-society relations and the Cold War. Florence, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for Bing's kind invitation and provide this platform for me to share some of the findings in my new book. Let's begin to look at the core theme of this book. So this book is mainly about Hong Kong, of course, as the title has indicated, which was one of Britain's last strategically important colonial dependency. And it mainly looked at how a reformist colonial administration investigates Chinese political culture, in particular how activism by social movement in Hong Kong impact on policy making. The most important part of this book, I believe, is to look at the increased organizational capacity of the colonial state at that time. So mainly focusing on two covert mechanisms that was embedded in the CDO scheme, that is Tang Tok and Moot. So at that time in colonial Hong Kong people had extremely limited political rights. There was no democracy. So this book mainly try to explore how constructive public opinion was used in policy making and how these opinion are mainly used by the colonial state to respond to public needs and to minimize social conflicts. So in terms of source and structure, as Ben has just introduced, I'm a historian. So this book actually utilized a lot of underexplored archival data. So they are mainly in London, in the National Archives, the Hong Kong Public Record Office. There is also special collections in, for example, the Hong Kong University Library, the Hong Kong Baptist University LC Chu private papers, and also some of the student newsletter that were that was stored in a CUHK Library Hong Kong collections. So apart from official sources, there would also be unofficial sources such as Chinese and English newspaper reportage. Mainly, we use these historical sources because I'm trying to overcome the limitation in work done by political scientists and sociologists that were actually dominate this field previously. So this book is more like empirically driven. So the core theme of this book is, as the title has indicated, covert colonialism. So I'm going to look at the mechanism of Tang Tok and Moot, and there are also seven case studies. So the first case study is the Chinese as the official language movement, and the second case study is the anti-corruption campaign. The third case study is the campaign against telephone rate increase, and a fourth chapter is on the Pressure Blood Golden Jubilee Secondary School dispute, and then the fifth chapter is on the immigration from mainland China, mainly looking at the creation and also the abolition of the Touch Bay policy. And then the sixth chapter is on the British Nationality Act controversy. And the last chapter, I'm going to look at constitutional reforms related to representative assemblies in Hong Kong. So basically, all these seven case studies try to show how this mechanism was utilized and also show the process of like how public opinions was managed to transfer into the policy making process. Even Hong Kong did not have a representative government system at that time. So let me talk a bit more about like the period. So the book starts in 1966 and ends in 1997. So the reason why it started at in 1966 is because for those that are familiar with Hong Kong history, they would know that it was the year that the Star Ferry riots actually broke out in Hong Kong. So we can see it was like a watershed in Hong Kong history, signifying changing political culture locally. And in that year, following that year, we also have the 1967 riots that was like kind of like influenced by the Cultural Revolution in mainland China. So in this period, we can see the internal and external security in Hong Kong was inseparable as well. And if we look at the broader picture, we can also see in this period the British Empire was actually declining because it has lost a lot of strategically important places after the Second World War. So for example, India were lost, and also like the Suez Canal, etc., etc. And the period also witnessed changing Sino-British relations as well. And at times, we can see Sino-British relations actually deteriorate. So by 1969, after the riots, after the 1966 and 1967 riots, the colonial government actually understood that Hong Kong future must inevitably lie in China. So it was just a matter of time that they have to retreat. But in the time being, when they were still in Hong Kong, the colonial bureaucrat have to find ways to develop a sense of civic pride as a substitute for national loyalty. And these will be very important bargaining chips for them to prepare for future negotiation with China as well. And in the same period, we can also see the political system was changing. Even there was not a lot of like constitutional reform in the earlier period. So in that period, there was this partially elected urban council in Hong Kong, but it did not really have much executive power. So there was still an absence of a direct state society communication channels. And that was the time after the two riots that I've just mentioned, the City District Officer Scheme, CDO scheme, was introduced in 1968. So that is actually the focus of this book. And in the same period, especially after the 70s, we can also see Hong Kong has a series of legislative and institutional reforms, especially during Mak Lee Ho's era, that was also known as the Golden Era to some historians. So the period actually lasts from 1971 to 82. So for example, in this period, we can see Chinese finally became official language of Hong Kong. The ICAC, Independent Commission Against Corruption, was set up in 1974. Touch-free policy was introduced first in 1974, but then abolished in 1980. And there was also introduction of free education as well. And of course, at the same time, we can see state-society relations and also political cultures were also shifting. And economically, of course, it's an important period because we can see Hong Kong was undergoing industrialization and later turned into this center of commerce and also finance as well. So all these are actually very important precursor to political and social changes, even in today's post-colonial Hong Kong. And some may be curious how I come up with this topic. So this is actually derived from my PhD thesis when I was at York back then. So I was reading a lot of literature about Hong Kong state society relations, but these literature were mainly written by political scientists and sociologists. So for example, historian George Endicott argued that Hong Kong was actually a minimum of government in the style of Baphomet laissez-faire. So he wrote his work in 1964, quite early. But then other sociologists and political scientists in the 70s seems to also support his ideas. So for example, J.S. Hoadley, Ambrose Cain, and also Norman Miners also believe that these are minimum government was like also due to the fact that people were not really interested in politics, and there was like clearly low level of political participation. And some of them also argued that it was the refugee mentality because most of the population in Hong Kong were migrants or like refugees from mainland China trying to go to Hong Kong to escape from the political turmoil, basically. So they were more like influenced by this refugee mentality of like try not to rock the boat and to ensure that the environment was like politically stable. And they were also influenced by these like Confucius values, for example, like try not to stir social conflicts, try to emphasize on social harmony, to more focus on the moral characters of the leaders rather than how the government was actually formed, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, with all these characteristics, the colonial government, according to the scholars, they were managed to gain legitimacy through this practice of like co-options. So in Ambrose King word, that is the administrative absorption of politics. So basically, by incorporating these, some of them are were leaders, business elite, and later some of the members at the grassroots level through the CDO scheme, the colonial government was able to gain a legitimacy without even introducing any sort of like democratic reforms. And in 1982, we can see this idea was actually further developed by a sociologist, Lau Siu Gai. So he argued that Hong Kong was a minimally integrated socio-political system, which means that on the one hand, the Hong Kong Chinese, they were politically aloof, mainly influenced by the concept of utilitarianistic familism. That is, they were place their family interests above that of the society. And on the other hand, the colonial government also did not have these organizational capacity to penetrate into the Chinese society as well. And all the existing and networks or like communication channel between the state and the society were relatively weak, according to Lau. However, recently we learned that this is actually an inaccurate view. Yes, Hong Kong to some extent was quite politically stable, but does it mean that there was no active that does it mean that there were absence of like political activism, or does it mean that people were like completely apathetic about like the developments or like public affairs? So that is actually not an accurate view, and we understand now as a historian, a lot of these like sociologists or like political science literature, they mainly rely on theories and also interview data. Some of them were actually quite ahistorical as well. So it actually missed out a lot of like useful information about context. And of course, there were other important factors that were not really explored in this existing sociologists and also political science literature, such as like demographics. And these older literature tend to treat the population more as a homogeneous entity. And we now have more books or like articles that were written by revisionists, showing that the state was actually very active when it comes to intervention. And also there was increased political mobilization in the Chinese society as well. So some of the work maybe, for example, we can look at Michael Ng's recent book published by the Cambridge University Press that is showing that how pervasive censorship was in Hong Kong post-war period. And of course, Ray Yap's work on the 1967 riot also showed how emergency regulations were used during the riots. So all these literature actually show us that there was increased state reforms and intrusion, which of course the previous literature did not mention. And one of the things that this book also hoped to do, apart from like responding to like the earlier literature that I've just mentioned, is to answer the question whether Hong Kong fits into the general pattern of decolonization or more was an outlier of outliner in the British Empire. So we can see after the Second World War, there was a lot of anti-colonial nationalism or like insurgency in the British Empire. But Hong Kong seems to be an anomaly, for example, suggested by historian like John Darwin. So for Hong Kong, it did not seem to have a lot of like movement or like attempts by the society to overthrow the colonial state. But at the same time, we can also look at the political system of Hong Kong in the immediate post-war period. It was largely unreformed. So for example, the Legislative Council, many of the members still appointed by the governor, they were mainly professionals and business elite. Similarly, in the Executive Council, councillors were also appointed by governor or the queen. And then we have the Urban Council, as mentioned, but of course, it possessed a very little executive power and also have a very narrow franchise. So, in a sense, there was a lack of direct channels for mass political participation in this period. So this book basically tried to respond to all these arguments of like the earlier sociologists, political science writing about state-society relations, and also like the ideas that whether Hong Kong was an outlier in terms of decolonization in the British Empire. So what are the arguments of this book? So this book mainly argues that the colonial administration possessed increased organizational capacity in the period after all these reform. So in particular, the focus of this book, the City District Officer Scheme, shows that the colonial government was active in investing in its surveillance apparatus since the late 1960s. In particular, the covert opinion polling system, Tan Tock and Moot, aim to construct public opinions and then feed them back to the policy making process. So these are mechanism was actually a carefully constructed statecraft. It allowed Hong Kong Chinese to influence policy formulation in a subtle way at the discretion of the colonial state without having to introduce democratic electoral reform that may provoke China resistance and politicize the Chinese population in Hong Kong. And the second part of this book also look at these increased political activism and diverse political cultures among different people in different age group, in different social class, and based on this finding, it would argue that the Hong Kong case was actually far from an anomaly. So it basically was only utilizing some old tactics of imperial rule to new circumstances that were unique to Hong Kong. And of course, Hong Kong has its own mechanism and own form of colonialism and decolonization because of these unique geopolitics. That is exactly why all these mechanisms were actually covert rather than overt. So let's talk about the origins of Tan Tock and Moot, that is the covert mechanisms that we have been talking about. So since the founding of the PRC, the PRC has always viewed that the treaty that governed Hong Kong were unequal and also invalid. It therefore has always been opposed to Hong Kong's democratization. By 1950s, the colonial government was still uncertain about like the attitudes of the Chinese government. But by the mid 1960s, it was pretty sure that China would not accept any attempts by the colonial government or like by the British government to democratize Hong Kong. This view was actually widely accepted among the colonial bureaucrats. This assumption was basically because these colonial bureaucrats associate changes in constitutional status or like the introduction of democratic electoral reforms to self-government and independence based on their experiences in other British colonies. And by 1967, after the 1967 riots, it was very clear that China would object to any democratic development in Hong Kong. And another concern that the colonial government had was that if elections were actually allowed or like introduced in colonial Hong Kong, then it would basically entangle Hong Kong into the Cold War politics. So there could be emergence of both pro-nationalist and also pro-communist Hong Kong-based politicians, which was a scenario that, of course, they did not want to see. And it is important for us to know that Hong Kong at that time was actually very much militarily vulnerable. So immediately after the formation of the PRC, Hong Kong's garrison has actually been strengthened. However, it was soon scaled down again, and mainly because of the Korean War. And at the same time, we can see that Hong Kong's strategic interest in general has diminished for the British after the Second World War. And even the British tried to ask for the US help to defend Hong Kong in cases of like a potential Chinese invasion. The US was extremely reluctant. So by 1952, in internal report, we could actually see that the British government had reached this agreement that if there was any full-scale attack by the Communist China, at that point, they would just evacuate. So they basically would not really defend Hong Kong. So in other words, because of the fact that Hong Kong was militarily indefensible. So the internal stability and also external security of Hong Kong largely was rest on the Chinese government decision to maintain the status quo. So basically, a normal relationship that could allow the British to continue to administrate Hong Kong. So this is one direct quote from the Hong Kong Public Record Office. Basically, the colonial government believed that they should try to avoid provoking China unnecessarily and consider very carefully any actions to which the Chinese People's Government would feel bound to react to, which included the introduction of democratic reforms that would challenge China's sovereignty over Hong Kong and open the door to a confrontation between left-wing and also right-wing supporters. So that explain why there was no major constitutional or like democratic reforms in the immediately post-war period in Hong Kong. So this is another direct quote also from a document that's called Aims and Policy of the Hong Kong Government in the Hong Kong Public Records Office. So these documents says many people will tell us and often do that none of this is as effective in promoting the rights of the citizens as democratic self-government. But it is commonly held that the Chinese government will accept the status of Hong Kong only for as long as there are no constitutional developments which may be interpreted as pointing towards self-government. You will therefore not find in government policy any intention to promote sophisticated Western democratic institution. We have to get our public participation in other ways. So these actually explain the origins of town talk and mute as some sort of like imperfect substitute for democratic reforms in Hong Kong. So when the CDO scheme, City District Officer scheme, was introduced in 1968, before that, there were also other channels of communication, but most of them were indirect. For example, we can see the colonial government had been monitoring a lot of like Chinese presses to get a sense of like public opinion. There were also Kaifeng associations through these Kaifeng leaders. They tried to get a sense of like what people, men in the street actually thought of different like important issues or like the government policies. But by the late 1960s, it was very obvious that these channels were no longer working effectively. So, for example, the colonial secretary E.B. Teasdale, he mentioned that all these measures or like these existing mechanism still leave a good deal of ground untouched. And more importantly, these Kaifeng Association, they were actually in decline in the later period. So we can see they become increasingly difficult to recruit younger members as well. So it was in this context that the City District Office scheme was introduced as the first direct state society communication channel, which aimed to increase political participation without implementing democratic reforms. It also aligned with the informal devolution of power. So this is another direct quote from the Hong Kong Public Record Office. The people of Hong Kong will realize that the policies of Hong Kong government were in their best interest and a sound method of local government could be developed so that the colonial government could govern and determine in partnership with those who live here what is right for Hong Kong and its people and not abdicate to external pressure. The CDO scheme was actually a multifunctional political structure. So it aimed to act as eyes and ears of the government. So basically help to have these civilians monitor changing public opinions and also like learn what was the gossips or like what did the people in the street really talk about like every day. And at the same time, it was also a voice of the government as well. Through that, the officer would also try to explain government policy and also answer public inquiries and also manage district affairs. So these City District Officers, they were actually intended to be political officers and they have considerable influence in the district. So their functions were to foresee local problems and conflicts and to initiate proposals for changes when needs were apparent. And one very interesting mechanism that was embedded in the CDO scheme was the town talk. So we can look at town talk. What is town talk? So town talk basically was a covert opinion poll that tried to incorporate the lower strata of the society into the administrative system and policy-making process. So another direct quote from the Hong Kong Public Record Office documents. We've just mentioned that a substitute for representative democracy was needed because Western democratic institution could not be promoted in Hong Kong, and other ways for political participation had to be sought. So these town talk mechanism actually help the colonial government to detect any strong current or public feelings and solicit views of men in the street from different walks of life. And we can look at these two other quote from the PRO as well. So it was mentioned that when policies and programs are being formulated, much attention is focused upon the relevance of informed and independent opinion. Indeed, this process is probably taken further in Hong Kong than in most territories. In particular, the City District Office scheme opened up new opportunities in this direction, and every advantage should be taken of this scope it offers for consulting public opinions on particular district projects. So it is very obvious that the colonial government hope to use this covert mechanism to solicit public views, but at the same time to basically use them as input when they were formulating policies and programs. And the second quote is colonial government performance to be compared reasonably well with that achieved by more formal democratic process that exists in the West, especially in entertaining complaints and consulting the public. So you can see at the from the colonial government perspective, they believe that these covert mechanism actually work fairly well in Hong Kong and could be comparable to democratic reforms in other countries. So why this mechanism had to be covert? So I think one very important point that we mentioned was China's likely opposition. It was because of the geopolitics, it was just not possible to introduce major constitutional changes in Hong Kong in that period. And if the colonial government tried to introduce these changes, it would be possible that there would just be more like potential popular demands for other changes, like constitutional changes as well. So they have to look for a substitute for this representative democracy. And another usefulness of this mechanism for the colonial government is that the degree of the society political engagement was completely controlled by the government because this mechanism was covert and the public was not aware of its existence. In this case, even there were a lot of exercise that had been done, a lot of monitoring. It still provide this leeway for the colonial government to decide when to listen or when not to listen to public opinions. So we can see it is a very interesting colonial statecraft that was a due attempt by the colonial state to expand its organizational capacity to gather intelligence on public opinion on the one hand, but also to widen channels of political participation on the other hand. So in terms of manpower, cost, and methodologies, we can see since the very beginning of this project, the colonial government has been very serious and invest a lot. So for example, we can look at the manpower in 1968. Town talk already have over 100 reporting officers, and each exercise would take about like 110 hours, costing quite a lot of money, more than 1,300. And then it also states that comments solicited could not be selected, but have to be random. So this is to ensure that they can have the opinions of people of different social class in different areas of different occupations. And then the officers were supposed to frame their questions in a neutral ways as well. As mentioned, because they hope that these are this sort of like exercise could be done in some sort of like random way. It basically suggests that these officers should not interview people in the same social groups for an excessive numbers. And whenever they encounter people that try to imply that the government was inefficient, the government was corrupt, and other problems, they should not agree with this view, but instead they should provide a rational account of the government. So we can see that town talk did not only try to provide intelligence to the government or like to find out about these public opinions. It also have this function trying to shape public opinions and improve the image of the colonial government. So we can see that in this exercise that people of different groups of different social class, occupation, and geographical areas These respondents would be included. And in terms of dissemination, so after all these exercises have been done, they would be organized into reports that is, of course, called town talk. And then they will be circulated to high-ranked civil servants and policymakers who will take time to read it and often discuss it with heads of department. So high-ranked colonial bureaucrats. And town talk was actually restricted. So its existence was concealed from the public. Not only the public, but in fact, the government also hoped that it would not get into hands of junior officers. So this is mainly to avoid the criticism of being a civilian state and also help the colonial government to control the level of the so-called political participation. So we can see that even town talk has this like dual attempt. Its function as an intelligent device was prioritized to that of like increasing popular political participation. So there were a lot of evidence that seems to suggest that a town talk really was influencing policy at the policy making process. So for example, this is a quote from David Lai, the City District Commissioner of Kowloon in 1969. He said, "There's no doubt that the town talk paper had become not just an information paper on what people have been talking about in town, but an increasingly effective paper to get departments into action. This is largely because the importance given to the paper by the governor, and also that implied criticism in some cases of government departments." So, some examples that I can find in the National Archives in London was that a town talk was actually also partly contribute to the setting up of the ICAC, the Independent Commission Against Corruption in Hong Kong in 1974. So we can see during the discussion process whether an independent commission or a inquiry that was like more like appointed by London in London should be set up. Town Talk actually had these like analyzed or public opinions about it. And according to these files in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, it says Town Talk of 2nd of August said that several people have suggested the British government should now launch a full separate investigation into the Galbraith case, as again this a UK and inquiry would be a major blow to Hong Kong's amour propre. So we can see that in this case, the comments or the public opinions that was recorded in town hall were actually taken into consideration when it comes to these institutional change. So from this case, we can see that town talk actually facilitate to widen the channel of political participation. Even in this period, we can see this continued absence of a democratic electoral system in Hong Kong. So at that time, because of the importance of town talk, we can see there is a more reforms in the mechanism itself. So we can see that, for example, the sample size was expanded. So previously, they did not really state how many people you should interview, but now at least you have to interview like 600 people. It also start adopting this quota sampling system, and of course, it's district by district. So basically, these 600 people distribution will be based on the distribution of gender, age, and occupation in that area. A random sampling method, however, was ruled out mainly because of the insufficient manpower at that time and how expensive it could be. So all these changes actually helped to turn town talk into a more reliable exercise and help the colonial government to have a greater reach into the Chinese society. Because previously within the colonial bureaucracy, there were these criticism that town talk was mostly unsystematic. It was very impressionistic, but did not have any statistical support. But however, because of these like criticism about like town talk, the colonial government decided in 1975 it has to introduce exercise called MOOD, that is movement of opinion direction. So MOOD was actually a successor of Town Talk, but it was supposed to be a more authoritative and therefore influential public opinion poll. It mainly draw attention to subjects which were at that time currently or potentially a public concern. It also hoped to assess public reactions, attitudes, and feelings in appropriate instances, and collect opinions that were not reported by the news media. And it would also examine the impact of the press on public opinion, some public misconceptions, and the voices of the less articulate classes who otherwise couldn't get their views heard or would have difficulties and therefore suffer in silence. More importantly, controversial topics and anti-government activities would also be examined. So the whole reform turning Town Talk into MOOD was basically hoping to have a more credible and refined and methodologies. So, for example, like previously, we noticed that some of the CDO actually would interview the better informed respondent more frequently, means that there was no comprehensive view of a cross section of communities in Hong Kong. And the fact that it was usually organized on a weekly basis also means that the CDO would have very limited time for full investigation of the issues. And sometimes the reports also reflect more like the bias of the officials, therefore, like distorting public opinion as well. So to expand the sampling size to prevent these more informed respondent to be interviewed repeatedly. So now we have a new method. So for example, we can see that the sample was expanded by using data supplied by the mutual aid committees and also the Kai Fong Association. And now each staff would have a 50-person contact list, and every week, one third of the people were removed and then replaced by new contacts. And then the community information unit also would be responsible for continuing to monitor media comments to understand sentiments of sensitive groups. And now the sample size had also been expanded. Rather than only interviewing at least 600 people, it now interviewed at least 2,500 people. So in this 2,500 people, the details of age group, class, educational background, type of residence, gender, and occupation would also be provided. And because MOOD was still a qualitative exercise, so it still adhered to using unstructured sampling method and also interviewing techniques. By 1977, we can see that just in conducting this MOOD exercise, we have at least between 150 and 250 monitors. And the regular updated contact list now have more than 10,000 people. So to cover a wider cross section of Hong Kong and to make it like more random, less selective, we can also see there was increase in incidental contact at least by 2,000 to 3,000. And it was specified that no respondent should be interviewed more than once in less than 4 months. And of course, there were still a lot of like interviewing questions because some of them were mainly like qualitative exercise. So it depends on the nature of the exercise and also like the question that or the topic that they are trying to find out. Sometimes it was through observation, sometimes it could be through a questionnaire, sometimes it was through interviews. And it is interesting to also point out that MOOD actually also borrows some of the system from Osaka Feedback Scheme and also the Japanese Monitor for National Policy as well. So it was not exactly completely original, but it actually borrowed ideas from other system and tried to adapt that to the Hong Kong unique environment. And in terms of interviewing techniques, in order to get to the heart of these respondents, basically, these CDO were instructed not to standardize their questions or like not to have a like very specific orders when it comes to asking questions. And previously, we can see that because Town Talk mainly focusing on urban area of Hong Kong, that is Kowloon and Hong Kong Island, it really did not cover the new territory such as Tsuen Wan. But now we can see that by 1980, it start covering Chung Hwan and Hwai Chung, the new territories. It also start adopting a quota sampling method. That is the selection of contact was according to gender, age, and occupation, and now in proportion to the number and also distribution of the overall population in the area. However, for more important topics, such as like green paper or like future constitutional reforms or like the potential handover of Hong Kong, the colonial government still prefer to use more scientific methods that is like more statistically based rather than this like very qualitative exercise. And we can see because of the adoption of the quota sampling method, the exercise also reduced the sampling size now from 2,500 to 993. So I realize we are running out of time, but these exercise, as far as I can see, at least survive until November 1992. So this was actually the last copy of talking points. I guess that's the next version of MUTE that could be found in the archives. And Talking Point was a weekly record of issues of current interest collected from a small number of respondents in both urban and also new territory district issued every Friday. The reason why I guess like Talking Point was still in use was because the colonial government still care about like this qualitative aspect of public opinion. But at the same time, we can see compared to, for example, like the late 60s or like the 70s, these covert mechanism become way less significant. That was because there was increased democratization at the local level. For example, there was we begin to have the district board election in 1982. Of course, after the Sino-British Joint Declaration were reached, we can see even more constitutional reforms in Hong Kong. So there was this gradual decline of the paradigm of consultative politics in Hong Kong. And by the 1980s, as mentioned, when it comes to like more important topics that require more manpower or like that the colonial government would hope to have more statistical backing, they would actually contract that out to commercial polling and also research firm and sometimes universities as well. So we can see that yes, these covert mechanisms still exist now in the name of talking points, but it was actually become way less significant compared to that in the 1960s, late 1960s, and also the 1970s. So let's make a short conclusion. So in conclusion, based on this finding, we can argue that I guess Hong Kong was far from a minimally integrated socio-political system, unlike what Lau has suggested. So we can see the colonial government and the Chinese society interact frequently. And in particular, Tang Tong and MUTE, they were important mechanism for the colonial government to understand changing popular sentiments and also help them in policy making. And we can see this covert polling exercise was also institutionalized as well, embedded in the city district offices scheme. Means that the colonial government have both the wills and means to monitor the Chinese society and also to understand their public opinions as well. So that is the manifestation of covert colonialism. But at the same time, interestingly, these mechanism also allow ordinary people to take part in the policy formulation process in a state control, but in a state control and also a covert manner. So we can see that this priority, the priority of this exercise basically it focus more on like getting the intelligence for the colonial government to find out more about like public opinions to minimize social unrest is more was more important compared to really allowing these people to take more part in the policy formulation process. And mainly, it was introduced because the colonial government hoped not to provoke China or like further politicize the population as well. So the second part of this book, as we can see, like in those case study, actually we also talk about like the political cultures of different social class and age groups, which, however, I don't think we have enough time to cover in this conversation right now. So, for example, it will show that the upper and middle classes are opposed to political activism, and they saw a political activism actually incompatible with their social status. They tend to be more pro-status quo. But for the working class, they were less informed, but they could be mobilized when their interests were affected as well. They were mainly driven by instrumentalism. Middle-aged and elderly members of the society were more politically conservative. The young generation tend to have a more anti-colonial outlook. If you are interested, you're more than welcome to read the rest of the book, or like you can email me as well. And I guess lastly, because we can see that the CDO scheme itself was actually trying to basically when the CDO scheme was discussed, it draw experiences from, for example, the district officer scheme that were previously implemented in Africa. It also draw some of the mechanism and experiences from the People's Association in Singapore. And also, as we can see, of course, when it become moot, it also learned some of the technique and also borrowed some of the techniques from the Japanese system as well. So I would say that in this case, like Hong Kong was not exactly an anomaly, because we can see that it actually borrowed these ideas or like these statecraft from different places, but only adapted to like Hong Kong because of like Hong Kong unique geopolitics and environment. So I'm gonna stop talking now. So if Bing, you have any questions, then you're more than welcome to ask, or like if there's anything you would want to discuss in particular, please feel free.
Thank you for Florence for this delightful, interesting in presentation of her book. And for me, I think it's really a timely book regarding what has happened in Hong Kong in the past 10 years, and also regarding this relationship with China, with mainland China, and also in the greater China region. For me, while I was reading the book, I can see the line, the whole timeline, how Hong Kong become a democratic polity through these strategies administered by the colonial, by its colonial government. So I think it's quite a confusing concept, the covert colonialism, because I think it extend my understanding about colonialism to in a way. I actually quite interesting in how you picked those seven case studies, because to me, they are really rich for, and how do you come across these case studies, and on what ground that you decide to use these seven case studies instead of others, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. I mean, for these case studies, so because they were basically so most of the the selection of the case study mainly based on, of course, like archival findings as well. But I try to look at case study that involve like people of like different social class and age group. For example, like they were political activism or like social movement. But at the same time, those case study one have abundant record in the archives, whether in London, whether in Hong Kong, or like other special collections in different university, and also widely reported by newspaper. Two is like the case hasn't been really thoroughly covered by other existing work or like by other existing historians. So basically, these were the criteria that I used to look at to select the case studies. And also more importantly is like those case studies usually have an outcome. So sometimes that for example, the Chinese as an official language, people were fighting to turn to legalize Chinese as the official language of the state. And of course, like by 1974, they were successful because there was a law and ordinance that actually announced that Chinese was one of the official languages in Hong Kong. But in other cases, for example, like the British Nationality Act controversy in 1981, we can see even there were a lot of like the executive councillors, a lot of like some of the local Chinese that actually disapprove these change in terms of like nationality, which of course would affect the right to reside in the United Kingdom, because it affects, for example, other colonial dependency. It also affects like the metropole London. So these voices, these public voices, actually did not successfully persuade the British government to introduce like any changes. So we can see like usually they have these demand, but at the same time we can also see an outcome. So sometimes like yes, public opinion managed to make changes, like it could lead to like passage of like legislation, creation of new institution, but sometimes when it affects more places rather than just Hong Kong, when it affects the metropole that is London, the UK, then it would not have as powerful impact as like the other cases. So I think that are the main criteria like I was thinking about when selecting the case studies.
Maybe I think it's a quite interesting concept of the covert colonialism. I'm quite interested to know to what extent have town talk and mood, this kind of strategy, influenced the relationship between Hong Kong people and the colonial government at the time or even today, if you have any idea on this.
Okay, so thanks for the question. I cannot answer for like today's Hong Kong because my research stopped in 1997. So I don't really have much information about like a current Hong Kong, especially like archival data. But if you are asking about like the changing state society relations at that time, so there are a few things that we can understand from this book or like from this research. So I think one is we can see the colonial government trying to become increasingly responsive to public opinions if it could, because obviously we understand that after the 66 and 67 riots, there was this like problem of legitimacy for the colonial government. So it is important for them to like to stay in touch with changing public opinions and to minimize the chance of like similar events to happen again. So we can see this initiative. But at the same time, because it's colonialism, right? So we can also see that the colonial government, even they were keen to be more responsive, or like they reform these communication channels, they still prioritize their own interests. That is to gather this intelligence, because this is for their legitimacy and this is like for the stability of Hong Kong. But also two is that simply because it's covert, it actually give them these advantages that they can just decide when to listen or not to listen to public opinions. Because imagine if this is overt, for example, if the colonial government have a large scale public survey on, I don't know, maybe constitutional change, and then maybe it suggests that majority actually support constitutional change, and at the end it did not really listen to public opinion, what would happen? So the covert nature of this exercise actually prevent this sort of situation from happening and give the colonial government a considerable amount of flexibility or like leeway when it comes to policy making. So you can see that yes, even like it seems like there were more channel for the Chinese society to express their opinions and also to ask for changes, but at the same time the colonial government still have their own interest. And I mean, the presentation just now probably haven't covered everything, but we can see the political cultures were changing as well. So in the book itself, it actually talks about how people have changing views towards the colonial government, towards Hong Kong, or like a specific policy or change as well. So previously, I guess the old generation that were migrants or like that have this so-called refugee mentality, they tend to be more afraid of officialdom. So unless there was something major, they would try not to, for example, contact the police. It was also because the police was also quite corrupt at that time, because we can see that corruption was actually quite serious in Hong Kong before the ICAC was formed. And the corruption department was actually located within the police force as well. So people did not have this confidence to reach out to officials when they need help. But we can see very obviously in the 70s, since the 70s, these have been changing. So people became more vocal when they see something that was like unjust, or like they were not happy about specific policy, they would be more willing to speak out, basically. So we can see that some of the case study, for example, Chinese as the official language, it did not only involve like the students groups that were like the usual like active historical actors in the period, but it also involved a lot of like working class, ordinary people that also care about the language issues as well. So I guess another thing we can see is like these changing state society relations. So obviously there was changing ways or approach taken by the colonial government to handle issues in the Chinese society to try to be more responsive, but at the same time provide themselves a certain degree of flexibility. But at the same time, we can also see the Chinese society, they become more vocal, they become more active. And I think it's a two-way thing. So you can see how the society was actually moving towards like the Hong Kong, maybe like in the 1990s, or like even after the handover, like the Hong Kong now, because I think like all these actually facilitate the emergence of these new political cultures.
Yes, that's but that's also comes to my last question. Maybe how do you think is any government with, that uses these kind of mobilizes public participation into political culture, these strategies, a colonial one or a democratic one, if that's the
I mean, I am a Hong Kong historian, so I cannot like give very precise information of like what other geographical areas or like what other countries were doing or are doing. But I mean, from the Hong Kong case, we can see that these sort of situation were used in different places. So for example, I mentioned about like in Africa, in Singapore, or like Japan have also been using some similar monitoring system. So I guess it is if we talk about surveillance in general, or like opinion monitoring, it would be very common in all sorts of societies, of course. But I guess it's more like how the state make use of the opinion that they solicit. So that actually would define what actually whether it was like colonial in some sense, or like whether it was democratic, if it makes sense. Yeah.
yes, I think that's more. Yes, we can use these history provided to explore these concepts further because it's always changing the society, the state society relationship is also changing, which comes to like we thanks Florence for today and we've taken up a lot of time, so that's why I'm asking, what's your next project that regarding Hong Kong's studies, if you are doing anything interesting, I please.
I mean, at the moment, me and my team in NTU Singapore, we have set up this Hong Kong Research Hub. So we are actually working together on a project that is about water shortages and water supply. So it's quite different from this project on Quebec colonialism, but it also related in some sense, because part of the project also explore like state society relations during crisis, especially these water crisis in the 60s. And we can look at like how the crisis management techniques change over time as well. But of course, there were other parts of the project that are also quite new to me. For example, we will look at like more environmental history, the development of different like water infrastructure from a reservoir to like desalination plants, to catch water, et cetera, et cetera. And we would also try to look at how water affect like popular culture and also entertainment as well. So we can see, for example, some of you may know, there were popular culture like movies or drama that are like specifically on the topic of water shortage. There were songs as well, like some of you may have think of Sam Ho's Zai Zai Go. So a lot of these are very interesting things. So if you are interested in our new water project, please stay in touch. And we will have more upcoming events. Many of them are actually hybrid in March and April.
Thank you. That sounds really good. I'm really happy that we now there are many Hong Kong study or Hong Kong research hubs that can really treat Hong Kong as a academic subject rather than it's always within Chinese studio and or something like that. I really hope to talk to you again for on about your new projects, and thank you for being on the show today. Now we must say goodbye to our audience. We will say goodbye.
Thank you so much. If you're interested, then just send me an email and we can talk more about like the book or like other projects.
Okay, say goodbye, everyone. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.